today is the winter solstice, and so I'm going to be talking about the archetype of the solstice. And first I'll say the winter solstice, of course, is the shortest day of the year in the Northern Hemisphere. The sun is furthest south at this point in the year. And over the past 3 months, as the day has been getting shorter, the places of sunrise and sunset have been drifting further and further south, rising in the southeast, setting in the southwest, making these tiny arcs across the sky. And at the winter solstice, that's when they reach their southernmost point, and then they start coming back. Now, of course, for us modern people, you know, we've seen science textbooks, we've seen pictures from outer space. We have this larger view that, you know, this is part of a larger cycle, and it happens regularly like clockwork every year. This was a different experience for prehistoric humans, who would see the days getting darker, see the sun drifting further and further south, making smaller and smaller arcs across the sky. And it brought up the question, is this going to continue? Is the sun just going to disappear and all of light be swallowed up into darkness? And so the winter solstice was this magical kind of holiday for them. A kind of rebirth of the sun when it had ebbed to nothing. The birth of light at the heart of darkness. And that's really the archetype at the center of the winter solstice, the birth of light at the heart of darkness. And really this this archetype permeated not only the prehistoric religious holidays, but really also all the modern holidays that are associated with the winter solstice. I mean, in their own way, Christmas, Hanukkah, and Diwali all are, in one way or another, about the birth of light or the rejuvenation of light in a very dark place. And so this archetype, well, ancient people saw it as telling us something about the cosmos. Like any archetype, it describes an internal event. And primarily, I'll be talking about that internal event, the birth of light at the heart of darkness. This event is not necessarily different from alchemical events. You know, for example, turning lead into gold. That was also an inner event. Of course, in the Middle Ages, there were shysters who said they really could turn, you know, physical lead into physical gold. But the true masters knew that it was not about the physical objects, that it was an internal experience that they were after. And it's funny, the modern holidays, Christmas, Hanukkah, Diwali, carry all kinds of clues about this archetype. And so I'm actually going to read a passage from the Bible, a very familiar passage from the Christmas story, to talk about this archetype. This is from the Gospel according to St. Luke in the Bible. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be enrolled. In other words, he was giving a census. And everyone went to his own city. And Joseph went up from Galilee, the city of Nazareth, to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be enrolled with his wife Mary. And while they were there, the time came for her to be delivered, And she gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger, because there was no place for them at the inn. And in that region there were shepherds out in the field, keeping watch over their flocks by night. And the angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were filled with fear. And the angel said to them, "Be not afraid, for behold, I bring you good news of great joy, which will come to all people. For to you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. And this will be a sign for you. You will find a babe wrapped in swaddling clothes and lying in a manger." And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host, praising God and saying, "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace among men with whom he is pleased." So there's a lot about that story that is fascinating and significant. I always find the angelic announcement to the shepherds particularly interesting. You know, in the context of the story, let's just, for the sake of argument, let's just assume the story for a second. You know, God was born on earth. That's a big deal. So it makes sense that there be some kind of big announcement. The announcement doesn't go to Caesar Augustus, the emperor of Rome. It doesn't go to the political elite. It doesn't go to the religious elite. And there were plenty of religious elite in ancient Palestine, experts on Torah. Doesn't go to anyone who is aristocratic or noble or of any kind of rank. It goes to shepherds. Now, in no period of history are shepherds ever, the highest status. But in this period of time, they were really slaves. Their lives were worth less than the animals they were taking care of. They were really at the bottom of the social scale. And the angelic announcement goes specially to them. And it's interesting, it's part of a larger pattern. I mean, Jesus himself was born as a traveler, as someone whose life was in flux. And, you know, his parents, obviously, there probably would have been more comfortable places to stay in Bethlehem if they had money, but this is what you do when you have no money. You stay in an animal manger, you know, and that's where he was born. And we see this, it's actually a theme throughout the New Testament, that he's reaching out to social outcasts. He's reaching out to lepers and tax collectors and prostitutes and all the people who were rejects from society. And this gives us a profound clue to the nature of the archetype, the birth of light at the heart of darkness. It seems that you might say that the sacred or healing energy has a particular affinity for the parts of us that are most rejected, for the parts of us that have been most wounded, that have been most cast out from the center of our psyche. It certainly seems that the sacred has the least affinity with ego, you know, insofar as I'm, you know, thinking, well, I'm in charge and I'm special and all that. That's the furthest I can be from the sacred, you know, when I'm wrapped up in ego. And really the places that are most rejected, most othered, are the ones that, as it were, most invite the sacred. And so it's an interesting question just to ponder. What are the places in you that are most rejected? What are the places in you that have been most othered or most pushed away in some way? Most buried in inattention and neglect? I'm going to share a couple visual images here. There are two images on this. The first is a painting by Jung, and this painting is actually called The Light at the Heart of Darkness. And it's an awfully compelling image of this indomitable light in this very dark place. And then the second, on the second page, is from the tarot. This is the Five of Pentacles. And we get this image of these poor beggar people who are clearly not in good shape, and they're outside the lighted church. And it's snowing out there, you know? And I find this a particularly potent image of, in some ways, this is what the rejected places in us look like. This, they're the wounded beggar children that are off in the alleys, that kind of thing. And when the birth of light in the heart of darkness happens, it's, as it were, a healing to these places, a healing to these places that have been most rejected. And so it's also a very interesting question, where in us is darkness? Where is the darkness in our body? What are the dark places in our psyche? Usually darkness means the places where we're not paying attention. You know, and it's this paradox. And in some ways it's very sad. You know, there may be a place in our childhood where we were hurt or traumatized or neglected. And then because it's painful throughout our adult life, we continue to neglect. And so we're heaping further and further neglect on this place that originally was neglected, you know, that kind of thing. What would it mean simply to bring attention, to bring compassionate attention to the places that you have always ignored? What would it mean to bring compassionate attention to the places that you have never allowed yourself to feel before? And chances are good that if it's a place that I've allowed myself never to feel before, there might be a lot of charge there, you know? And so the first articulation of it might be something that feels almost intolerable, you know? And so how do you work with something that is most intolerable? Well, you can't face it all at once. You'd be overwhelmed. You know, can you face just the tiniest edge of it? And then the next day, maybe the tiniest edge and a little bit more. And then maybe just a little bit more each day. And over time, you grow your container and you're able to hold that energy. And so there's a magic that comes, and there's a healing that comes, even when we start to pay attention, even when we start to ask the questions, this place in me that has never spoken before, what does it need? Like, even just to ask that question starts a deep healing cycle. The birth of light at the heart of darkness is an event of healing coming in and transforming one of these broken places. And it's really an event that can happen over and over again. It's not just a one-time event. As healing deepens into us, we experience over and over again the birth of light at the heart of darkness. And so it's an interesting question. What is our relationship to darkness? And sometimes it even can be great to play around with physical darkness. You know, what if we turn the lights off in our room? You know, that kind of thing. What is our relationship to darkness? And often our relationship to external darkness gives us a clue about our relationship to internal darkness. Can we be at peace with darkness? Can we enter our own darkness with courage and with equanimity? So I'm going to share a poem about darkness. Link is in the chat there. Sweet darkness, when your eyes are tired, the world is tired also. When your vision has gone, no part of the world can find you. Time to go into the dark, where the night has eyes to recognize its own. There you can be sure you are not beyond love. The dark will be your home tonight. The night will give you a horizon further than you can see. You must learn one thing. The world was made to be free in. Give up all the other worlds except the one to which you belong. Sometimes it takes darkness and the sweet confinement of your loneliness to learn. Anything or anyone that does not bring you alive is too small for you. You know, and it is in some ways the gift of that very conscious darkness that we can discover both in the inner world and the outer world. What are the relationships that bring us most alive? What are the relationships that bring us most alive with others in the world? What are the relationships that bring us most alive with our own selves? And that bringing something to life that was not alive before is the birth of light at the heart of darkness. So with that, I'm going to share the quote sheet. A lot of links in chat tonight. Here's the quote sheet. From the Buddha. This is from the Buddha's, some of his last words before he died. Be a lamp unto yourself. Make of yourself a light. And so this whole idea that, you know, from the Buddha's point of view, it is our responsibility to be this light for ourselves. Rumi said, don't turn away. Keep your gaze on the bandaged place. That's where the light enters you. Hafiz said, how did the rose ever open its heart and give to the world all its beauty? It felt the encouragement of light against its being. Otherwise, we all remain too frightened. The Christian mystic Julian of Norwich said, As far as we can discern, the sole purpose of human existence is to kindle a light in the darkness of mere being. Oops. Need a drink of water, I'm losing my voice. Emerson said, to the dull mind, all nature is leaden. To the illumined mind, the whole world burns and sparkles with light. And so this birth of light is both an internal as well as an external event. There are shifts, internal shifts, that actually make the world brighter. Groucho, in his own inimitable way, says, blessed are the cracked, for they shall let in the light. Henry Miller said, "The moment one gives close attention to anything, even a blade of grass, it becomes mysterious, awesome, indescribably magnificent world in itself." Paramahansa Yogananda said, "Every shadow of life is the great light of God." Kind of odd to think that Groucho Marx was older than Paramahansa Yogananda. Anais Yin said, "When you possess light within, then you see it externally." Simon Weil says, "Even if our effort of attention seemed for years to be producing nothing, one day a light that is in exact proportion to them will flood the soul." Pirviliat Inayat Khan said, "The light of awareness, the light of consciousness, arises out of a broken heart. The heart, by breaking, becomes an ocean accommodating all beings." John Cornforth says, "Truth is seldom the sudden light that shows it new order and beauty. More often, truth is the uncharted rock that sinks a ship in the dark." He was a scientist, but what he was talking about was actually applies very well to personal growth as well. Marion Woodman said, "Body work must be approached with the same respect and attention one gives to dreams. The body has wisdom of its own. However slowly and circuitously that wisdom manifests, once it is experienced, it is a foundation, a basis of knowing that gives confidence and total support to the ego. To reach its wisdom requires absolute concentration, dropping the mind into the body, breathing into whatever is ready to be released, and allowing the process of expression until the negative damned energy is out, making room for positive energy, genuine light, to flood in." Wendell Berry said, fascinating, to go into the dark with a light is to know the light. To know the dark, go dark." One of my favorite quotes from Mary Oliver, "This is the first, wildest, and wisest thing I know, that the soul exists and that it is built entirely out of attention." Hugh Prather says, "It's not that we fear the places of darkness, but that we don't think we are worth the effort to find the place of light." Paul Keolo said, "When you find your path, you must not be afraid. You need to have sufficient courage to make mistakes. Disappointment, defeat, and despair are the tools God uses to show us the way." Tara Brock says, "If our hearts are ready for anything, we are free to be ourselves. There's room for the wildness of our animal selves, for intimacy and understanding, creativity and productivity. There's room for spirit, for the light of awareness to suffuse our moments. The Tibetans describe this confidence to be who we are as the lion's roar." Muji said, quite simply, "Your heart is the light of this world. Don't cover it with your mind." Bani Mayodi Trie says, "We think hitting the ground, knocking over the barrier, is a mistake. But the ground we hit, the failure we experience, is not a mistake. The world is endlessly mysterious. Experience is profound to a degree that will always surprise us, but it is never a mistake. To foster even a meager appreciation of that, and when we're in the midst of a fall, meager is pretty big, is to begin to practice to raise the Bodhi mind. It is the decision to stop complaining and start paying attention. Contained in the fall is exactly what we need to stand. Everything we need is available, but we need to invite it." Greg Anderson said, "One thing has to change for us to know happiness in our lives, where we focus our attention." And Mark and Angel Chernoff said, "You become the true master of life when you learn how to master your focus, where your attention goes. You value what you give your energy to."